Hello and welcome to the Muni Lowdown. My name is Paul Graves and I'm the managing editor for DebtWire Municipals. Today's podcast title is Cyber Attacks 101. I'm joined by our curation editor, Stephanie Fagnani, and cybersecurity content specialist, Bradley Bart. We'll be discussing cybersecurity challenges faced by government and nonprofit organizations. Welcome back to the podcast, Stephanie.
Thanks, Paul. It's good to be here. Hi, Brad.
Hi there, Stephanie. Good to talk to you.
And Bradley, welcome to the podcast for the first time. We're excited to have you. And first, I want to start off with, could you share a little bit more about your background in the cybersecurity field?
Yeah, happy to do that, Paul. And it's great to talk to you, too. Thank you so much for the invite. I come with a good decade or so of cybersecurity subject matter expertise. I was formerly a reporter and then later editor with SC Media, one of the prominent cybersecurity publications that's out there. And currently, as of today, I'm actually a content specialist on the event side of things, where I help arrange various conferences and webinars with cybersecurity experts, making sure that all of our content is very much relevant, on point, and topical.
So with that as a backdrop, given the increased number of cyber attacks in multiple municipal sectors, ranging from school districts, higher education, hospitals, local municipalities in terms of cities, counties, and towns, do these entities have enough in-house expertise, number one? And number two, do they need to supplement their in-house security programs with a third-party vendor?
I think in a lot of cases, this is a pretty prudent idea, especially for municipalities, school districts, because as we do know, the budget to hire expertise is somewhat limited, and it's a very competitive field, cybersecurity, in terms of talent. A lot of private sector companies, corporations are going to hire away probably the top talent in the field when you're looking for really experienced CISOs being chief information security officer. So with those pretty hefty salaries and the competitive nature of cybersecurity jobs, it's generally a good idea to see if you can supplement the help that does exist within your organization with some kind of an outsourced service. So in a lot of cases, that might be something like a virtual CISO or a vCISO, as they call it, service. Or it would be an MSSP, a managed security services provider. But it's these kind of outsourced services that you can contract with to basically help give you that additional talent that you may not otherwise have within the walls of your organization. You know, cyber is not a solo act. You're going to need a support team. Going with one of these services can help you basically scale up your cyber programs so that you can maybe areas that you otherwise would struggle to prop up yourself, you can have assistance with, whether that's with managed threat detection and response or managed compliance or any a number of things that you might need.
So would there be any disadvantage to partnering with a third party as opposed to keeping things in-house? You know, there's that saying that we've all heard growing up, too many cooks spoil the soup. Is there any application to that within cybersecurity?
Yeah, there are always pros and cons to these things. And certainly there are a lot of pros to using something like an MSSP, many of which I just mentioned before in terms of getting more of that qualified expertise. The downside to it, of course, is you may lack a little bit of the day-to-day control that you're looking for over your cybersecurity operations, as you're essentially ceding some of that control to an external organization. Now, of course, you'll work with that external organization as closely as possible to make sure that you are aligned with your vision. But having said that, you know, they're also working with other organizations as well in many cases. And so you're obviously sharing their time, you're sharing their resources. So those are all things that you have to work out basically in advance of your relationship to get a little bit of a better sense as to how that working relationship is going to go. There can be misalignment in how you envision your security program will be executed in terms of things like scope. What aspects of your cybersecurity program do you want to handle yourself? What do you want to leave to the outside organization? And to what extent? You know, what gets covered contractually? Where does the liability fall in the unfortunate event that something does go wrong? In that sense, an MSSP or a vCISO service is effectively like a third-party services provider. And so you have to treat them as such. In a lot of cases, you may even have them fill out a third-party assessment questionnaire, allowing them to declare in writing what their security posture is. So you can also ask for, you know, referrals and testimonials. You'll want to identify the scope of the services that they're providing and make sure that all of that is covered and understood before getting into a relationship with them. Having said that, if you do it the right way, it can be a tremendous boon and benefit to your cybersecurity program.
Earlier, Paul mentioned a couple of sectors that we've written about in terms of cyber attacks and whatnot, you know, school districts, local municipalities, hospitals. Are any organizations more vulnerable to cyber attacks based on their size or their particular sector or their ability to afford, you know, help in that cybersecurity department? And following up with that question, we had talked before the meeting and you mentioned soft targets. I wondered if you could also expand on that concept.
Yeah, certainly. I'd be happy to do so. Yeah, you know, you gave me before, Stephanie, sort of that old saying of too many cooks, right? So I can give you sort of an old saying too, right? Or there's the joke at least about, you know, what is like the two guys running away from the bear or the lion. And the one guy says, you know, well, how am I going to outrun this bear? And the other guy says, I don't have to outrun the bear. I have to outrun you, you know, and that's effectively what cybersecurity can be sometimes, that if you're the weaker target for many malicious actors, they're going to look for organizations that may have a weaker security posture. If you have a multi-layered defense, then you may not be as appealing of a target. That's not always the case. There are certainly always going to be these nation-state threats, advanced persistent threats, very sophisticated cyber criminal groups that may have their eyes on the prize in terms of a really top-tier target that you know, they're basically investing all their resources into attack. But for a lot of cyber criminals, they're looking for the easy target. And so certainly, again, municipalities, school districts, entities of that nature are going to be a little more enticing because of the aforementioned limited budgets, limited resources. They're softer targets. And so in a lot of cases, because of that, you know, they're an easy get.
I'm also actually wondering, you know, we've seen cyber attacks described in different ways. So could you explain the different levels, whether it be ransomware versus a data breach? And also, I want to get your opinion on whether the victim should pay and whether that depends on what kind of attack it is, et cetera.
There are all different kinds of cyber attacks that exist. I think in the particular area or domain that you cover, it's going to be certainly some of the most common attacks that you're going to find will be of the data breach variety, the ransomware variety. And maybe in the case of certain entities like cities and towns, you know, maybe some cyber espionage or even sabotage as well if critical infrastructure is involved. Those are some of the key areas. So as you know, data breach, of course, is the exfiltration essentially of sensitive data. A lot of times it can be PII, personally identifiable information. If you're a company, it would be your customers. If you're a municipality, it might be your residents, your local citizens. If you're a school district, it's going to be your student body, things of that nature. And certainly with a data breach, you know, why do they steal your data or view your data? Well, in a lot of cases, it can be to sell it on the underground black market. It's of value to people so that they can later on use it to commit identity fraud, credit card fraud, things of that nature. The actors who breach the data, steal the data in the first place, may be directly doing that, or it's possible that they just may be collecting the information and selling it to a second party on one of those underground cyber criminal forums. With ransomware, obviously, that's been basically plaguing a lot of IT and cybersecurity departments for quite a number of years now, where there's an extortion factor, where files are being either encrypted and or stolen. There's still a breach element to it. And then the victims are being extorted for large sums of money. If you want to have access to your systems again, access to your data again, if you don't want us to use this data that we've gotten our hands on in a malicious fashion, then you need to, you know, pay us a certain sum. And of course, that gets into the question of whether, you know, you should be paying. And I can get to that in a moment. And then, you know, the other things that I mentioned, too, there can be cyber espionage. Certainly, it could be a situation where whoever the malicious entity is, they're trying to gather strategic information for whatever their nefarious purposes are. If there's critical infrastructure involved, there's always the chance that they're trying to execute some kind of a physical attack on a system, you know, be it something like an energy utility or a water utility, things of that nature. As to whether you want to pay the attackers in the case of some kind of an extortion attack that involves a ransomware, like an encryptor, or making sure that the data isn't being used in some kind of way. I mean, most experts, or certainly like the FBI, will tell you, ideally, you shouldn't be paying. It only further encourages such behavior and helps just continue to prop up the cyber criminal economy. Having said that, it's not always practical to follow that advice. Sometimes you're really in a tough spot and you don't have much choice to pay, because the financial hit of not paying can actually be worse. If you don't have the proper data backups, if you don't have business continuity protocols in place, if you don't have disaster recovery in place, the cost and the time and the effort to basically reset back to normal can be worse than just paying the malicious actor in the first place. So ideally, you don't want to do it, but there are a lot of companies that realize that, oh, this could be a months long process to get back to normal. The reputational hit that we're going to have by not being able to provide our proper services, by having to basically go back to the Stone Age and do everything by, you know, pen and paper until we can get our electronic services back up and running. Sometimes they don't have a choice. Now, I will say there are certain cases where certain cyber criminal organizations, certain ransomware actors might be criminally sanctioned organizations by an entity like the Department of Treasury. And you certainly want to make sure that you're not paying an officially legally sanctioned criminal enterprise, or some of these groups are considered terrorist groups, because then you'd be basically funding a criminal group, which can be an illegal act. But it, like I said, in many cases, these victims find themselves in a tough spot, and it's tough for them to do anything but pay.
So, Bradley, it's interesting how the human mind works. I've found you to be a very delightful human being, but the things you're telling me, Bradley, are frightening. So when I look at you, I get a bit nervous, because I'm finding out things that I wasn't aware of and that are going on. And it seems like this is pretty difficult to contain and deal with. And it leads me into my next set of questions around incident response and, in my opinion, lack thereof of incident response, because what got us here at DebtWire Munis on this whole topic is that we have a disclosure site called the Electronic Municipal Marketplace Access, also known as EMMA. And every so often there'll be a filing about, oh, there was this breach, but basically everything is okay. And basically the filing is pretty much useless, because it doesn't tell you anything. And then when we try to follow up, we get the obligatory, well, it's under investigation, we can't tell you anything else about this, we'll get back to you later. And I'll say this, in every situation that we've heard or been told that, well, there's nothing to worry about, everything is fine, every situation, 2, 3, 4 months later, some point down the road, we find out, oh, by the way, there was like 100,000 people lost, you know, had their data exposed, and this is a big problem. First, how should municipalities and organizations handle incidents response?
Excellent question. First of all, thank you. I'm glad I'm coming across nicely to you. I think the ratio that I'm going for in this particular interview is 50% charming, 50% alarming. Charming, alarming is what I'm basically going for here. Yes, it can be scary. And I understand that frustration over incident response and how sometimes you feel like the communications can be insufficient, which in some cases they can be. I mean, incident response is a very, very core aspect of anyone's cybersecurity program. And really, a good incident response plan involves more than just your cybersecurity department and your IT department. It involves all of the internal stakeholders in your organization that any kind of incident might touch. So you're going to want to have your executive team involved. You're going to want to have your legal team involved. You're going to want to have your PR communications team involved. All of that basically is important because, as you said, you know, you want to make sure too that you're being responsible in your disclosures. And that also at times requires the deft touch of a legal department that needs to let you know what you should be or shouldn't be saying at any particular time, your communications department to make sure that you're being properly candid and at the same time clearly and concisely communicating with the public the facts that they need to know. So a good incident response usually involves an incident response playbook, which you should obviously be working on well in advance of any kind of an attack, that spells out who the key stakeholders are, what their roles and responsibilities will be, what is your communication plan, what's your containment plan. All of those things are going to be important to look at. You know, ironically, incident response relies heavily on not just what you do post-incident, but really relies heavily on what you're doing in advance of any incident happening, like I said before. And that's not just the building of the playbook, but it's also things like conducting training or tabletop exercises within your organization to have simulation scenarios for what if we do suffer a major ransomware attack? What do we do in that case? Having security awareness programs throughout your entire organization so that there's a consistent philosophy and security policy covered across your entire team. Making sure that you have data backups, perhaps in multiple spots, and disaster recovery protocols set up as well. In terms of why it feels like some of those disclosures are ineffective sometimes, well, sometimes it can be because the course of an investigation reveals things over time, and it can take time to do a proper investigation into your data logs to see what has been exfiltrated, to really fully understand where the initial intrusion within your systems took place. You know, you look at, for example, what happened. We talked about this a little bit in one of our preliminary discussions, the PowerSchool incident with the huge data breach that happened there. And from what I've at least seen from initial disclosures, it talks about a single employee credential being used to basically that it was compromised and used to access a lot of this information. So that might be a good initial thing to share. Down the line, people might want to know, how was that particular credential compromised? Was it through a phishing scam? Did that particular employee receive an email? Think it was from perhaps a colleague, a supplier of some kind, you know, whatever happened that they ended up giving away their credentials. Did the school district not use multi-factor authentication? I think I've seen some reports saying that MFA wasn't enabled there. And these are things that the public will also want to know so they can get a better sense as to, well, what are you doing in the future to prevent something like this happening again? And there are no-nos. And I remember writing about this a little bit as a reporter at times or conducting other webinars asking incident response experts, what are some of the things that, you know, you don't want to do? And so you don't want to undersell a major incident that happens and make it sound like, oh, well, right now there's no sign of any misuse. So we think this is going to be fairly contained. And then the next thing you know, you learn a couple of months later, oh, wait, there are the names up in the black market on a cybercrime forum. So you don't want to withhold key information. Sometimes you don't want to be too hasty about revealing information that maybe you're revealing or disclosing too soon. It is a balancing act. And there are even things like, again, just not mischaracterizing what happened. A lot of people look at a few years ago when there was a data breach involving Uber. And one of the criticisms of Uber was that they made it sound like rather than them actually paying off an attacker, they were actually giving a reward to a researcher that found a security hole within their organization, when the reality is that this was not an authorized breach into their system. So, you know, why make it sound like that's what it was when the reality is that you were victimized? So these are all things that you want to think about how you are properly disclosing contextually what happened within your organization. I don't know, those are at least some of my thoughts. Hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you. And then for our audience, just so they're aware, PowerSchools, they're an online service provider in the state of Indiana. They were dealing with at least a couple of hundred school districts, and they were a victim of a cyber attack. So that's what prompted their inclusion here. And I'll also let you know, Bradley, you are striking a great balance at being charming and alarming. So thank you for that. Last question for you. You were talking about incident response, and it seems like incident response varies from state to state and from sector to sector. Would there be any value in having a federal data breach law in place?
Yes, there would be value in it, especially from a sense of having a consistency of expectations, consistency of compliance and enforcement. However, that has been a very difficult undertaking over the years to get representatives across states to agree on the terms and provisions of any such federal data breach legislation. There has been at times opposition from key members of the tech industry in terms of wanting to make sure that any such federal law wouldn't curtail some of their operations like data collection, things of that nature. And so there's been resistance in that sense. The good news, of course, is that every state does have some version of a data breach law. Some are certainly stronger than others. I think a lot of people in the cybersecurity industry hold up California as being the gold standard of data breach laws. And probably they are the standard bearer. From a federal perspective, you do at least have certain entities and agencies like the FTC or the SEC that, from a regulatory perspective, can crack down as needed at times on organizations that perhaps showed a clear lack of responsibility and accountability when it comes to data breaches. So there is some enforcement element there. That's been sort of a long time coming thing that really just hasn't borne fruit yet, is the idea of having that federal law. Until maybe we see some kind of shift in attitudes there, we might have to settle with going state by state.
Well, thanks, Bradley and Stephanie, for the great discussion on cybersecurity for municipal bond issuers. Shout out to our podcast producer, Anthony Phillips, who always makes sure that our mics sound right. To our audience, I hope you found this podcast to be informative. Please support us by liking, sharing, or subscribing to Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Until the next time, thanks for joining us on the Muni Lowdown.